I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
It's good to be with you again, Ken. And you were mentioning an article you saw a little while ago in the Weekend Fin Review.
Yes. You know, with all the media commentary, I'd always thought that the mining sector provided the greatest contribution to Australia's exports. But apparently that's not strictly true, is it?
No, you're right. It's not exactly true. And to appreciate why, you have to have some understanding of the global supply chains and how value is added along the way to arrive at the full implication. And even that is fragmented across a number of countries. And so when you're trying to establish which and how much each component contributes to the final product, you've really got to get down and measure the value fairly precisely. And, you know, if you look at from the ABS figures, the official trade data will tell you that services only accounts for 22% of our gross exports. And that means that relative to the two majors, resources at 40 and manufacturing at 38, it's what you might call a poor cousin. But the other thing you ought to look at is that those numbers that are put out look upon a load of iron ore heading for China or a shipment of Holden's going to Saudi Arabia. They literally look at it strictly as iron ore and cars. What they don't do is to dissect it and recognise the embedded contributions of all the other sectors in the economy in getting those exports into the condition to be exported and also delivering them to those ports overseas. Now, as you can appreciate, the Chinese and the Saudis are paying for far more than just iron ore and cars. I mean, they're paying for the use of the ships, port facilities, the railways, the accountants, lawyers and scientists along the way, and all the other inputs that go to get the goods from here to their docks. So many of those services will have been produced and employed outside of the resources and manufacturing sectors, and therefore the raw figures just don't reflect it. But, you know, Australia's economy is no longer driven by what we make. In other words, the extraction and the production of physical goods. Instead, it's measured by what we know and what we do. And like most other developed economies around the world, we continue to become more and more knowledge intensive and globally connected. And as such, you'll find the services sector exports represent a fairly large chunk of the overall output, but it's there as an invisible component. It's contained within something else, either the iron ore or the cars or whatever it is that we're exporting. And, you know, what you have to do is to actually break it down and dissect it, for want of a better word, to measure the value-added component of the different sectors that, when put together, make up the total export that takes place. And this, you have statisticians that do just this, but a lot of the times it's not reported. And in the cases of the service sector, it amounts to the value of the service sector output less the produced inputs like cars and computers, and you adjust it for things like taxes and subsidies. Now, you might say it's a bit complicated, but the reason for that is that what you've got to do is avoid double counting. And you've got to arrive at Australia's gross domestic product. And unless you do it that way, you end up counting more than once the various components that go in. Now, rather than go into an in-depth further discussion on it, there was the Reserve Bank put out a chart recently which made the comparison, and I'll dig out a copy of that and include that as part of this podcast. So if people who are listening will go to propertybriefings.com and go to episode 68, underneath there will be, in the resources section, a chart which will show the comparison. Now, on the basis of the value-added exports, you'll find that services actually contribute more to our exports than both the resources and manufacturing sectors, which comes as a surprise because, as I said, a lot of them are already hidden in there. But when you look at it as a value-added, they actually add more than the raw materials being exported or the components for cars and any computers or whatever that we're actually exporting. So it's an interesting comparison. So I'll put that up and you can have a look at that.
And furthermore, I'd always thought that China and Japan were way out in front. I mean, as far as our largest export markets. And yet, that's not altogether true either.
Now, again, it gets rather complicated because a lot of the iron ore, which has these embedded services and in making up the export that we sell to China and Japan, ends up being re-exported in the form of rolled steel or cars or other manufactured products. Now, our iron ore miners are actually contributing to global supply chains that are centred on China and Japan, but often end up in North America or the European markets. Now, when you look at it that way, and particularly the value-added component, it turns out that North America is actually our largest value-added export market. It's got, if you look at the chart I'll put up, it's got about 15.8, nearly 16% of the share of the value-added, which is just ahead of Europe, which is 15.7, and China and Japan, which are both 15%. So North America is actually our greatest export market. And I think Julie Bishop made that point a few months ago, which surprised a lot of people and thought that we were insulting China. But in actual fact, it's a true statement. Now, you may well have been aware of some of this because of the benefits that the resource boom actually spread out of the two mining states of Western Australia and Queensland, where those states were actually purchasing services and some other manufactured goods to use in those states from the non-mining states themselves. So the services sector actually played an important role in capturing the benefits of the boom, the resources boom, from a lot of the foreign-owned miners. And the size of the service sector's exposure to the export sector might have come as a bit of a surprise. And there's actually an important difference between providing services to an Australian exporter and actually going out and marketing those services like Australian education or tourism and business services directly to foreigners. But it's when you combine the two that you actually see the true value of the service sector to the Australian economy.
Okay, now that you've explained these apparent anomalies, how is all of this likely to affect commercial property?
Well, you need to understand that the services industries that help get the iron ore and holdings to Middle East and China, they're still subject to fluctuations in global markets. And when the global competition gets tough, the Australian exporters are under pressure to cut their costs. And these pressures of globalisation will only increase. And I think recently the US Federal Reserve predicted that about a third of the jobs in the US, and that's including highly skilled professionals, will eventually become susceptible to outsourcing to lower wage countries such as India. Now, what they're predicting in the US is likely to flow through and eventuate in Australia as well. But having said that, in and around the capital cities in Australia, and I'm talking, you know, the close in the cities, not necessarily the immediate suburbs, but the ring of suburbs around the capital cities in Australia, that obviously provides the best opportunity for face-to-face contact among the workers within the knowledge and service sectors that are providing these invisible inputs to the main players that are, in some respects, located within the CBDs themselves. And it's only by being able to jointly solve problems that by pooling their knowledge that the necessary innovations continue to occur, and the creative ways of doing things more efficiently can take place. And the reality is that these sort of complex exchanges are really best done one-on-one, face-to-face, and in person. And sure, you can have video link-ups and Skype and all that sort of communication, but more often than not, it's best done over a cup of coffee or in someone's office and just exchanging the ideas and letting the mind run free. And I think this is what's been driving a lot of the suburban office demand over the last decade or so. And, you know, you've got to look at areas that have sprung up, particularly, and I'm thinking of Melbourne now, around Monash University. There's a whole office precinct that has sprung up there where smaller offices are feeding off larger ones, particularly of research and development work done at universities. So they're little incubator type offices. And likewise at La Trobe Uni on the other side of Melbourne to the north and west there, that the offices that have sprung up there and it's become quite a precinct for smaller strata titled office businesses operating there that need to be in that collaborative environment so that they can develop the ideas and provide these value-added services. So this is what is going to happen, and you're not going to be able to replace all of those. Some of the repetitive ones like call centres and those sort of service-type jobs that you don't necessarily need face-to-face contact, but the ones where there's collaboration required, that's always going to require close-knit, easy access to like-minded people.
And are you likely to see each capital city responding the same way?
You're probably not going to see every capital city responding the same way going forward. Look, for a number of years now, I've held the view that Melbourne has by far the greatest stability of all the capital cities when you're comparing it as far as the commercial market. I'm thinking mainly the office market. And I think that's probably validated by the fact that 80% of my clients are from interstate, and yet they are wanting to purchase property in Melbourne. And I guess that's because Melbourne enjoys a far greater diversity in its tenancy mix. And over the years, there's never really been any sort of definitive study or analysis that clearly confirmed that, until there was some work done, I think it was by Colliers, following the global financial crisis, and I think it was about 3 or 4 years into that, that they bought out a chart showing the sublease market around Australia and the amount of space, the split of space between the different sectors as a result of major firms downsizing and wanting to, they were still committed under their lease, but they wanted to sublease space. So this was sort of a hidden vacancy. You had the real vacancy, but you had this hidden vacancy as well. But you were able to measure it because you could actually take it by firm and by industry and therefore work out the relative proportions. Now, what I'll do is also include a chart of that too, because I think it's very interesting. Now, and what you'll see from the chart is that every CBD, and that's other than Melbourne, has a major exposure to one specific market sector. Now, for Sydney, it's the finance and insurance sector. For Brisbane, it's the mining, manufacturing and construction, as it is for Perth, the mining, manufacturing and construction. And for Canberra, it's information technology. Now, that surprised me a bit, but I just get the stats and try and interpret them. Now, as you'll appreciate, when any of these business sectors begin to surge, those capital city offices markets will respond rapidly with escalating rentals and prices. However, during an economic downturn like the GFC, those very same markets tend to suffer the most. So what you find is that with a well-balanced spread within its tenancy mix, the Melbourne office market has been better placed to withstand such economic gyrations. Now, while it may not reach the same heady peaks of some of the other cities like Brisbane and Perth and Sydney, nor does Melbourne plumb the depths that was experienced by those other capital cities when the global financial crisis hit. You know, whereas prices fell 30, 40%, vacancies have ballooned out. Even still now, vacancies in Perth and Brisbane are in double digits, in some cases 14%, going, they think, perhaps up to 16%. Sydney came off, probably 15, 20% drop. Melbourne probably was 8 to 10%. Now, the Melbourne vacancy rate is around about 8%. Sydney's a slightly higher. Sydney has a pretty major project, Barangaroo, coming on stream. So it's going to be interesting. But perhaps Melbourne as a market lacks the excitement, but instead it has historically been able to offer investors solid, predictable returns. And that's what you need to have in mind as far as a commercial property investor. I think, look, Sydney will return. That's not a problem. But the Melbourne and Sydney markets are what you call mature markets. In other words, they can better withstand any downturn, whereas the office markets in Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, Darwin and Canberra are not as mature and therefore are subject to the vagaries that will occur when the economy changes. So, you know, it's interesting, but it's just tying everything together and understanding how movements in sectors and industries can have a flow-on effect as far as commercial property is concerned.
Isn't it interesting how everything is somehow connected? And yet I think it's important our listeners appreciate that being a successful commercial property investor involves more than just researching various properties.
Yeah, you're right. It's often necessary to step back and take a helicopter view of things to identify and understand the emerging trends plus how they are likely to affect the various sectors of the commercial property market.
Anyway, Chris, look, thanks for your help in clarifying things today. And I would encourage listeners to leave their thoughts and comments below, and especially to let us know of any topics they'd like covered in future podcasts.